An April 2020 Forbes article, contributor Frank Holmes of U.S. Global Investors cited $9.6 trillion of outstanding corporate debt for U.S. firms. That excludes financial companies, meaning these are the firms that make products, transport us, and keep life on track. Companies borrowed big at low interest rates. Every 1% increase to that $9.6 trillion means $96 billion in additional interest expense. That's a big blow to profits. In some cases, it wipes them out entirely. That boosts the ranks of the zombie firms. This means if the U.S. allowed rates to find their free market levels set by actual buyers and sellers of bonds, many companies wouldn't make it. That in turn means they'd enter bankruptcy, their bonds often selling for pennies on the dollar. Remember, in a rigged market, the Fed sets the price. In a free market, the one with the cash sets the price. We'll never see that market again. As we barrel towards an inevitable financial reset, it's time to protect hard-earned wealth. Chapter 13, Paying People Not to Work. Free cash greases the wheels of the economy. That's according to Rutger Bregman, author of the book Utopia for Realists. Bregman advocates giving every person a baseline monthly income. Regardless of skill level, effort, schooling, or behavior, everyone gets a monthly stipend. He tells Mashable.com, once receiving a monthly stipend, people buy more, and that boosts employment and incomes. He says this guaranteed income gives people the individual freedom needed to quit their job if they hate it. This fosters the creative spirit. Bregman might sound like a radical. He's not. The concept of paying people not to work is already in place. Not so radical. During the virus panic of early 2020, a friend of mine got a call from his CPA. I want you to hire everyone you can, your mom, aunt, uncle, anyone with a social security number. Do it today. A successful entrepreneur, he told the CPA, these people don't have the skills to add any value to his advertising business. The CPA explained he needed to show a big payroll to get as much PPP money as possible before it ran out. PPP is the Payroll Protection Act, part of the CARES Act. The PPP loans employers as much as 2.5 times their normal monthly payroll expense. The loan carries an interest rate of 1%. At the end of the year, the government will review the loan and potentially turn it into a grant. According to the CPA, it's easy money. There's no such thing as a PPP in a free market. My friend is a free market entrepreneur. From his perspective, businesses succeed by meeting the needs of customers. They can only do that with excellent people. He'd never hire his distant relative who knows nothing about advertising. Everyone knows this is true when it comes to products. Some are just better than others. For instance, I enjoy a great cup of coffee. It takes more work to produce a great cup of coffee. The shop I like has an artisanal roasting process. It's completely different from the self-service coffee at the gas station. I'll pay more for it because it's great. Wine drinkers know all about this. Rare varietals, expertly processed and aged to perfection, sell for high prices because they're the best. People want the best. They want you to see that they have the best. Even in a suburban community where every home looks the same, people go to great lengths to show they have something better than their neighbor. No dinner party host has friends over and announces she'll serve average beef with an average bottle of wine. Imagine sitting in that average house looking at average art and wondering what you're doing there. The whole concept of average only exists if there's a top and a bottom. You don't know something is below average unless there's an above average. People understand this when it comes to food and wine. They struggle when it comes to individuals. Everyone is not equal. While we all look similar, two arms and legs, etc., we're not equal. My friend with the advertising agency and his staff are not equal. I remember when he started the agency 10 years ago. He couldn't take it anymore, slaving away at a large corporate agency. So he used his credit card to buy a laptop. He risked it all to start his own one-man agency. A decade later, he's a multimillionaire. He respects his staff. They're all smart, but not one of them helped him start the agency. there's a chance one of them will quit and start a competing agency one day. But at this time, he's the big boss because he took the biggest risk. In a free market, the risk takers who succeed reap the benefits. With several houses, a beautiful farm, numerous vehicles, and plenty of savings, my friend's big bet on himself paid off. That's why it's hard to hear the CPA explain that he needs to hire a bunch of very nice but unskilled relatives in order to get the PPP money. That PPP money flows into the PPPLF, Paycheck Protection Program Lending Facility, and once it's gone, there's no more free money. The whole thing doesn't make sense to people who think about it too much. Don't think about it. The answer is obvious. Rutger Bregman's Income for All is already here. The PPP loan means businesses like my friend's advertising agency continue paying workers while they stay at home during a virus quarantine. The quality of work coming out of these homebound workers is not equal. Some use a spare bedroom and keep regular hours. Some work more. Others work as little as possible. Nobody knows what's really happening because nobody can see. But the pay stays the same regardless in order to get the PPP loan. The PPP loans were part of the CARES Act. That also boosted unemployment compensation. Normally computed at the state level, the federal government added an extra $600 per week for the unemployed. $600 per week means an extra $15 per hour for the unemployed. That's straight from Washington, and on top of the state unemployment payments. Ironically, the federal payment of $15 an hour is the number floated as a basic wage. Basic wages are yesterday's news. The concept implies paying workers a minimum of $15 an hour for actual labor. This new program pays $15 an hour to people who don't work. People hear this and immediately say, some people need more help in challenging times. Oh, I thought we were all equal. Now you say some people aren't equal. They need more help. Well, which one is it? The whole thing is a farce. Call it what you want. PPP, PPPLF, CARES. It's all the same. Acronyms and controlled language mask the real message. We'll pay people not to work across the board soon. Who pays the people not working? Fast forward to Bregman's utopian society, where nobody takes a job they don't enjoy. Imagine how people spend their day. Maybe they take a bike ride, assuming someone enjoys building concrete bike paths for them. Every city would need people who enjoy trash collection, sewage treatment, and other tasks required in modern life. In my early teens, I had a job in my father's furniture warehouse. It's an old tobacco warehouse. In the summer, it feels like what I imagine the face of the sun must feel like. Plus, furniture comes in huge cardboard boxes. That creates a lot of dust. By 10 a.m., you're drenched in sweat and discolored from dust. Nobody would choose to do that job over a free stipend. Therefore, nobody would unload, receive, and reload furniture for delivery. All the people sitting at home playing video games during the workday would have to come get the box furniture themselves. Let's say there are 200 million working people in the country. If we pay those people $2,000 a month all year, that's $24,000 as a basic income. Multiplied by 200 million, that's $4.8 trillion, which Bregman says will produce individual freedom. The total size of the U.S. economy now is about $21 trillion. That's all the goods and services produced in a year. That means all we have to do is tax every cent of commercial activity by 22.5%, and we've got it covered. Sounds easy. Well, we've also got the rest of the government to fund. Surely we need soldiers, assuming they don't mind fighting. We also need highway workers, I guess. Then there's maintenance staff, safety people. We probably still need some government administrators to dole out the free money. Of the $4.4 trillion in 2019 government spending, I'm not sure what we'd cut. So now we're up to just under half of GDP. All we need to do is assess a 45% tax on all commercial activity, and we should be okay. The concept here is universal basic income, UBI. You'll hear more about it. That's how these things work. First, float a crazy idea. Next, give it an acronym that sounds useful. Then use a crisis to slip in the first taste of it to get people hooked. 10 years into it, they'll have no clue how they got into this tangle. Meanwhile, remember that the cost of paying people not to work is infinite. It fights human nature on every front. We both know it won't work. Trying it means unlimited spending. That means another radical increase in borrowing. We know federal debt grows until there's so much it smothers the economy below. With that engine smothered, it's hard to hold on to wealth through traditional means. Stocks don't keep up because business struggles. Bonds produce a small return, but the loss of purchasing power more than eats it up. It's essential to own something that benefits from the inevitable situation as it unfolds. Remember, while debt grows without limit, the gold supply tends to grow at around 1.5% per year. It takes immense stress and strain to produce gold. That's after a prospector takes excessive risk to look for, discover, and define the potential gold mine. This is a decade-long process at best. That's why there's only $10 trillion worth of gold above ground today. Compare that to world debt, which started 2020 over $250 trillion and may finish closer to $300 trillion. The total world gold supply is so small, it fills roughly three Olympic-sized swimming pools. Keep in mind, that's after mining for thousands of years. Gold's limited supply is the ultimate wealth protection in a world of limitless money creation. Chapter 14, Negative Interest Rates. Imagine receiving this note from your local bank. Dear valued customer, effective immediately, the interest rate on all account balances greater than $10,000 will be negative 1%. We will calculate interest based on your daily balance and assess the interest charge on the last business day of your statement cycle. Any balance under $10,000 will receive our standard 0% interest. We appreciate your business and loyalty. Sincerely, your local banker. Consider what this means. On a surplus $100,000 account balance, you'd lose $1,000 per year. The concept is negative interest rates. While this might sound impossible, it already exists. There are more than $11 trillion worth of government bonds across the world with interest yields below 0% today. At one point in 2019, there were more than $17 trillion worth. Japan had $5.8 trillion worth of negative yielding government bonds outstanding as of June 2019, according to Bloomberg. To be clear, this means the bond buyer pays the Japanese government a premium to own the bond. I know this is new for most people, so let's make sure we're on the same page. In the old days, you bought a government bond for $1,000 that carried a 5% coupon annual interest. Twice a year, you get a check for $25, representing a total annual interest payment of $50. When the bond matured, you'd get a check for your last interest payment plus the $1,000 face value. This is how bonds worked in the old days. The bonds we're talking about today, all $11 trillion of them, effectively work backwards. Assuming the same conditions as mentioned above, you'd buy a $1,000 government bond for $1,050. Assuming the bond matures 1 year later, the government would return $1,000. That means you paid the government 5% for the privilege of owning its bond. This is how negative interest rates work. It's not just Japan. France, Germany, Spain, and even some U.S. companies had negative yielding debts outstanding in mid-2019. There will be more. Why the Fed would mandate negative interest rates. For most people, the first instinct during turbulent times is to hoard cash. This doesn't always mean physical cash as much as it means bank deposits. It's hard to amass much physical cash. The $100 bill is the largest denomination today. There hasn't been a larger U.S. bill printed since 1945. The last $500, $1,000, $5,000, and $10,000 bills went out of circulation in 1969. Unless you run a criminal enterprise, chances are slim you hold more than $10,000 or $20,000 in physical cash. If you do, it's the exception, not the norm. Most of your cash ends up in money market funds. This is by design. Remember, money market funds used to pay interest. They loaned to reputable companies for short periods. They passed that interest to you as the depositor. That doesn't happen anymore, at least in an amount that has consequence. Even so, when the walls of the economy rattle, people still shove cash into money market funds and other accounts that used to be safe havens. The total quantity of money on deposit in these accounts surged during each of the 2002, 2008, and 2020 crisis periods. That's bad news for the Fed. Remember, it's trying to keep interest rates pinned at 0% while keeping tons of cash flowing through its member banks. When you pull your cash aside and wait for the dust to clear, you make the Fed's job more difficult. Soon, the Fed's interventions won't work at all. 0% rates can't make money any cheaper. However, negative rates can. Depositors would stimulate the fatigued system. Next time, you will fix the financial system. Remember, in 2019, bond buyers held $17 trillion worth of negative-yielding government debt. That means they paid to own it. Imagine what the other investment options look like if the best choice is paying the borrower to take your money. At the next sign of crisis, you'll respond as usual, shoving all your surplus savings, emergency funds, and retirement into money market funds. Then, you'll get that letter from your bank. Next, you'll try moving your money to a different bank. Same situation. Banks won't have a choice here. Banks earn money through what's called the net interest margin, NIM. This is the difference between the rate they pay savers and the rate they charge borrowers. For instance, if savers earn 1% on deposits and borrowers pay 5%, the bank has an NIM of 4%. This NIM spread doesn't change much outside of efficiencies and cost-cutting efforts. It can only go so low. As lending rates fall towards 0%, banks can't function. They need a cheaper source of funds. Deposit rates are already close to 0% now at most local banks. In order to stay in business, they may have to go negative. Out of options, you'd do the next logical thing. Pull your money out and put it to work somewhere else. Maybe you'd buy real estate. If it earned a 1% yield, you'd figure that's better than paying 1% to let it sit. Maybe you'd buy stocks. There might be a 2% dividend yield. Again, better than the bank. In both cases, there are risks. Real estate constantly depreciates. The roof, paint, plumbing, appliances, there's always a need for maintenance. That costs money. It would eat into your returns. Plus, you won't be the only one searching for a deal. There were $4.75 trillion worth of money market fund deposits in the U.S. as of May 2020, according to data from the Investment Company Institute, ICI. If negative interest rates pushed even half that idle cash into real estate, it would send prices higher. That in turn means lower expected returns. The same goes for stocks. Stocks go up when there are more buyers than sellers. Trillions sitting idle in money funds could light a spark under stock prices, regardless of worsening market fundamentals. You did the Fed's bidding. By taking your idle savings out of bank accounts and rushing to invest it, you did what the Fed failed to do. $4.75 trillion, or some portion of it, shoved into the economy kickstarts things. It gives the Fed one more crisis bubble cycle. Maybe more if you don't catch on quickly. This is a dangerous game. It's your hard-earned wealth that's on the line. The investments we're talking about come with risk. At some stage, you want to reduce risk and live your life, and you don't want to pay interest to do it. Gold always receives harsh criticism for being a 0% yielding asset. Warren Buffett chided the metal as useless. He said after digging it out of the earth, you melt it down, dig another hole, bury it again, and pay people to stand around guarding it. It has no utility. Anyone watching from Mars would be scratching their head. Which sounds crazier? Gold or negative interest rates? Chapter 15, Administrative Measures. Imagine it's a normal Sunday night at 7 p.m. You see a notification on your smartphone, an email from your bank, and a text from an informed friend all within a few minutes. Your bank will not open Monday morning. The email from the bank is friendly. It cites a Federal Reserve statement that banks across the country will not open on Monday. There's no need to worry. This is merely a bank holiday. Logically, you drive to an ATM to get some cash. There's a line of cars. The machine has a bank holiday message limiting withdrawals. Try another bank. Same thing. you'll have to get by on the cash you have or credit and debit cards. The next day, every major financial news outlet covers the bank holiday. The stock market opens like normal. You can buy and sell stocks, but cannot wire cash out of your account. Things seem somewhat normal. That night, the president and the Federal Reserve chairman make a joint statement about the bank holiday. Media outlets repeated the phrase bank holiday so many times it started to sound normal. A holiday sounds like a vacation. While it's a wise choice of words on the government's behalf, this is not the kind of vacation you want to go on. As the press conference ramps up, it's clear there's a major problem. The Fed chairman explains how rogue states conspired to damage the market for U.S. Treasury bonds with coordinated selling. He called the selling an attack. He explains that the Treasury bond market is the key mechanism the government uses to fund itself. It must borrow to fund a gigantic budget deficit. That means its spending is far in excess of revenues from tax collection. Any rise in interest rates renders the government insolvent. The president steps in and says we can't allow these bad actors to hurt the U.S. He goes on about the elderly needing medication and hungry children. He blames it all on foreign states. There's no mention of decades of borrowing to fund government overspending. The bank holiday puts the aggressors on their heels. That's the storyline, of course. The truth is, the U.S. government debt load became so large it crippled its economic engine. Like a business that runs up $5 of debt for every $1 in sales, it can't go on forever. Nobody wants to buy U.S. Treasury bonds anymore. To fix the last crisis, the Fed ushered in negative interest rates. People decided to spend their savings, avoiding paying the government for the privilege of buying its bonds. That pumped up the economy, blowing an even bigger bubble. Then the Fed was out of options. The good news is the bank holiday will end in a few days. The bad news is any account balance in excess of the FDIC deposit insurance limit will automatically be converted into U.S. Treasury bonds yielding negative 1%. In the real world, we'd call this theft, or at least a government seizure. It would surely violate some constitutional right. Not anymore. Constitutional rights take a back seat during times of crisis. Wisely, the Fed and Treasury would carefully choose the name for this seizure. It needs to sound important, formal, and beyond scrutiny. They'll call it administrative measures. You think this can't happen? Think again. It can certainly happen in the U.S. It already happened in the European Union in 2013. Without advance notice, depositors in the Mediterranean island nation of Cyprus, an EU member, lost access to their bank accounts. They could wait in line to use the ATM. However, there was a 100 euro daily withdrawal limit. This was a bank holiday at first. It turned into a seizure of any deposits in excess of 100,000 euro. Several years prior, Cyprus attracted large inflows of bank deposits. Its banks offered high interest rates to lure money in. That money, in turn, went to work in the country's financial system. The island nation boomed. The economic boom also boosted tax revenues. The local government sold bonds to finance additional spending in excess of tax revenues. Remember, governments can't help themselves when it comes to spending tomorrow's tax revenue today. In 2012, Cyprus ran into some trouble. The nearby Greek debt crisis created panic. Cyprus struggled to sell bonds. Unable to borrow more, it stood ready to default. Any government can spend in excess of tax revenues as long as someone buys its bonds. That's the government equivalent of taking a loan to live beyond its means. It works well until it doesn't. Eventually, bond investors sour and turn away. That's when it's all over in an instant. When that day came, EU leaders concocted a bail-in scheme already outlined in its legal code. A bail-in works like a bail-out, except for one major difference. Where a bail-out is a financial lifeline provided by government with the final bill passed on to taxpayers, bank customers fund the bail-in. Anyone holding more than the deposit limit of 100,000 euro would contribute to the stabilization effort. Think of this as a bank robbery in reverse. Instead of a rogue customer holding up the bank holds up the customers. 100,000 euro might sound like a lot of money. Soak the rich. The problem is, plenty of small businesses, retirees, or people saving for a big purchase have that in the bank account at some time in their adult life. In those cases, the seizure meant financial wipeout. A group of 676 customers who lost large deposits took up an unsuccessful legal action against the country and its banks. They suffered a collective $135 million loss in the seizure. Before you write off Cyprus as an island nation only suitable for vacations, not bank holidays, consider this. It enacted the bail-in measure under a European Union directive. That means the government and the banks acted legally in seizing customer deposits. This can happen in the U.S. To be clear, I didn't think up the idea of administrative measures myself. A European friend told me about it. A friend of his, who works in the French Ministry of the Economy and Finance, bragged to him that this legislation was in the drawer and ready to go if needed in a future crisis. The action makes so much sense from the government's perspective. It knows people hoard bank deposits during a crisis. In mid-2020, there was more than $4.75 trillion sitting idle in U.S. money market funds. If it struggles to sell debt, seizing that idle money is a logical fix. Administrative measures aren't the first domino to fall, though. These things work in succession. Throughout history, government action becomes progressively more desperate as the end nears. The U.S. Federal Reserve has several cards left to play before implementing a forced purchase of treasury bonds in a scheme like administrative measures. Each action seems unprecedented at first. Later, it seems ineffective. To stay inflated, the market needs more and more dramatic actions. After the U.S. government bought nearly $7 trillion worth of mortgage and treasury debt in an effort to peg interest rates at 0%, that action lost its effect on markets by 2020. That's why by mid-2020, the Fed for the first time started buying junk bonds. These are bonds issued by companies likely to go bust at the first sign of trouble. They usually carry high rates of interest to compensate buyers for the unusually high risk profile. In order to prevent a credit crisis, the Fed stepped in as a major buyer. The Fed may also begin buying stocks. This would prevent the stock market from going down. With the power to create unlimited amounts of currency, it could easily stabilize the $30 trillion U.S. stock market by stepping in as a buyer. Before you think it's crazy to imagine the Fed buying stocks, consider that the Swiss National Bank and the Central Bank of Japan bought large stock portfolios over the past few years. In the case of Japan, the central bank bought so many of its bonds it could no longer affect the market with purchases. It then started buying stocks. Today, it's among the largest holders of Japanese stocks. If things continue at their current pace, the Fed could run into the same dilemma. After buying up most of the treasury bonds and a major stock portfolio, the Fed would also run out of horsepower. At the first sign of economic weakness, it would need a new trick to ease crisis conditions. That's when administrative measures would be the next logical step for a central bank out of options. 50 years ago, nobody imagined the Fed would own $7 trillion worth of debt in an effort to fix interest rates at 0%. 5 years ago, nobody imagined the Fed would buy junk bonds. Based on its actions, which grow progressively more extreme in each crisis, it will one day bail in the financial system taking idle bank deposits as hostages. There's no limit to what the central bankers will do to hold on to power, creating trillions of dollars, choosing which companies get bailouts, mandatory bail-ins, or preferential lifelines. It does all of this with the power to create limitless quantities of U.S. dollars. The Fed creates its money in seconds without providing notice to people using it to store their life savings. It can boost the supply of dollars with computer keystrokes. Gold, on the other hand, requires effort to create. The gold supply grows at a naturally slow pace. Gold, with a finite supply, is the ultimate protection against governments as they run out of radical new tricks to fix the crises they created. Chapter 16, Modern Monetary Theory, MMT. Pay attention to the first thing that comes to mind about the man I'm about to describe. He opens a trading account with 4,000 British pounds, about $5,000. He asks his broker for the maximum margin loan possible. Think of this as a powerful yet dangerous line of credit. Trading on margin magnifies gains on winning trades. As any experienced trader will tell you, it can also multiply losses. His broker agrees to extend him credit, turning his 4,000 pounds into 40,000 pounds. This allowed him to swing bigger than he could on his own. Armed with 40,000 pounds, our trader steps into the market, carefully at first. After a few winners, confidence builds, no more fear. 8 months later, his initial 4,000 pounds is worth 18,000 pounds. That's the net value of his account after factoring in all costs associated with his borrowing. He's up a remarkable 350%. Emboldened, he bets big on his next trade. It's a bust. In 1 month, he turned a 14,000 pound profit into a 13,125 pound loss. Not only did he lose his initial 4,000 British pounds, he owed his broker for losing borrowed funds. When asked about this later, he said, "The market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent." He eventually did repay his brokerage debt. He also went on to become a famous author and economist. The centerpiece of his fame was a theory that governments could use leverage, borrowing, to shorten recessions. They could borrow and spend heavily during periods of sluggish economic growth. This would boost the economy back to health. As you can imagine, this was a popular message with politicians and bankers previously restricted by various gold standard type limitations. Our trader was John Maynard Keynes. He borrowed big and went bust. He made it all back later during a career of urging governments to do the same. When debt loses its power. Debt has a special power. There's a reason people call it leverage. Ancient Greek mathematician Archimedes said, "Give me a place to stand, and with a lever I will move the whole world." The concept is simple. Arrange the tools properly, and you can move objects no group of people could budge, even pushing with all their might. Archimedes worked with the power of leverage to move heavy objects. Money leverage works in a similar way. Say an apartment complex costs $2 million. You may be able to buy it with only $400,000 cash. You'd borrow the rest. That's leverage. With $400,000 invested, you now control a $2 million asset. All the way up the ladder, leverage works the same way. That is, until it doesn't. Money leverage differs from what Archimedes discovered in one important way. The amount of leverage needed to move the same object grows exponentially when it comes to money. When debt grows out of proportion to the system it levers, it loses its productivity. Simply put, the first dollar borrowed is the most powerful. Borrow more to pay back old loans, and somewhere down the road, you run into trouble. To keep this up over time, larger piles of debt with cheaper borrowing rates are a must. Otherwise, the debt comes due and it's unpayable. While governments don't go bust in the same way as a company or a person, they can smother their economies. Keynes didn't think this out. Keynes died 26 years after his 1920 trading experience. His books, speeches, and ideas about government borrowing became gospel for academics. Those academics taught the PhD students who'd go on to shape U.S. monetary policy. The modern cycle of boom and bust in the U.S. started in the 1960s. With the dollar on a fixed exchange to gold beginning in 1944, it took a few years to get off track. The U.S. slowly slipped into spendthrift behavior. Wars and welfare programs ramped up spending at home and abroad. Without cutbacks elsewhere, the U.S. ran persistent budget deficits. When tax revenues fell, it spent more, citing the work of Keynes as a solution. The past 20 years have seen this same pattern reach an extreme. Bubble crisis, with each bubble growing larger and each crisis more traumatic. It can't go on this way forever. Nature has a way of curing itself. You can't suppress forest fires indefinitely. If you do, the forest doesn't look natural. Fire has a way of eventually setting things straight. The same goes for an economy dead set on preventing recession. The first few times seem to work. Managing things during the tough years becomes popular with politicians because it reduces economic hardship. Bankers love the extra scraps that fall when the government borrows big. Eventually, bankers get tired of scraps and go for the whole stake. The final boom. Each crisis calls for a more radical solution. Economics is more like nature than economists would like to admit. Just as in nature, if you defy economic law, you merely delay the inevitable. The more you delay nature, the more it pushes back. Eventually, it's uncontrollable. When it seems like the U.S. money system is out of options, there's still one left. Keynes touted government spending to soften a recession. Next came lowering borrowing costs to urge more lending and spending. Then it was big federal programs to take debt off the books of banks. This was followed by paying people not to work, negative interest rates, which paradoxically charged bond buyers, and finally administrative measures forced buying of government debt. It seems like the end of the line, but it's not. At this stage in the progression, there'd be nobody willing to buy government debt, even if forced. Not even the speculators want to traffic in an endless flow of government junk. Enter modern monetary theory, MMT. Here's how it works. We know in normal times the U.S. government sells bonds to finance its spending deficit. That means spending in excess of what it receives in tax revenue. Since nobody wants to buy its bonds anymore, the Treasury sells one giant bond to the Federal Reserve. It carries a 0% interest rate, and it never matures. This is MMT. Long ago, when the Treasury sold tens of thousands of bonds to small investors, it faced scrutiny. Lots of eyeballs watched over the government's finance decisions. With MMT, those days are over. MMT is direct monetization of government expenditures. This means the jig is up. There's no need to talk down the deficit, promise restraint, or even plan for that matter. Government decides what it wants to spend, and the Fed finances it. Under MMT, the Treasury no longer has to hold a bond auction. Previously, it sold thousands of small bonds to investors, hedge funds, or companies. After all, for years, U.S. debt was a AAA-rated security. With its new financing scheme, that no longer matters. If its annual budget shortfall is $3 trillion, the Treasury issues one bond to the Federal Reserve in exchange for $3 trillion newly created dollars. Again, this bond carries 0% interest and never matures. That means the Treasury will never repay or refinance this bond. The premise of MMT is the government can create money to pay for anything from medical services to roads and bridges. It has the power to fund virtually limitless budget deficits by creating money to pay all bills and excessive tax revenue. Your first reaction is likely, this must trigger major inflation. After all, a limitless supply of dollars certainly diminishes the value of dollars. Sort of. But there's a bigger problem. Inflation is not the big problem. To fully understand the role of inflation, let's do a quick review. The first dollar borrowed by a solvent government has immense power. After the 1944 Bretton Woods Agreement, the U.S. dollar had a tie to gold of 35 to 1. This exchange standard meant a foreign bank could present $35 and receive an ounce of U.S. gold. If the U.S. government borrowed an extra $1, it was as good as gold. When that extra dollar hit the economy, it boosted overall output. Let's say back then, every $1 the Treasury borrowed and spent boosted U.S. GDP by $3. That means just a little borrowing went a long way during an economic soft patch. This gets addictive. Soon, you're solving every problem with more borrowed dollars. Government debt is leverage. Keynes was right. It boosts economic activity. Over time, the power of that leverage wanes. Instead of every $1 borrowed producing $3 of additional GDP, it falls to $2 and then to $1. It finally falls to less than the amount borrowed, making it a useless exercise. Put in terms of Archimedes, What once had the power to move Earth can barely move a pebble. Those extra dollars end up in the U.S. money system. People save them up and use them as capital to buy assets. They borrow to boost the size of the assets they can buy. Money and credit expand. That leads to more and more money chasing every imaginable opportunity, looking for every cent of profitable gain. Eventually, there's more money than opportunity. Too much supply, not enough demand. Next, all the surplus money starts chasing marginal opportunities. It builds more apartments than a city needs. It grows too much corn. It oversupplies the marketplace with more assets than the economy can handle. This is a long-term consequence of using debt to fix every economic problem. It's a lot like building a tolerance to pain medication. When overused, debt loses its productivity. Eventually, the economy doesn't function. The natural processes that clear excess and rid the market of bad operators haven't functioned in decades. Overbuilt and overburdened already, citizens of a once-free economic system cry out for help from the same people who caused the problem. MMT is their answer. When you hear the messaging, it's already too late. When MMT kicks in, it's too late. You can't buy fire insurance after your house burns down. We haven't had a dollar to gold exchange for 50 years. That's part of the reason why gold is worth 4,400% more than it was when the U.S. ended that exchange. The supply of dollars grew much faster than the supply of gold. Remember, U.S. citizens could legally own gold again beginning in 1974. It surged in value through the end of the decade, but paused for the following two. The 1980s and 1990s were a period of controlled money policy. Interest rates fell consistently over that period. Falling rates means lower borrowing cost. When this process happens in a steady way, it creates a reliable climate for investing in paper assets. Paper assets mean the value of something on paper. The company with billions of dollars in debt is worth a lot as long as it maintains access to more debt at lower cost. Once that access ends, the company returns to its true value. Hard assets are the opposite of paper assets. Their value isn't tied to the paper money and credit system. Hard assets hurt if you drop them on your foot. Paper assets don't. After its break from gold in 1971, the U.S. forced trading partners to use the dollar. That means it maintained its position as the world's formidable currency even after abandoning any tie to gold. It did not hold up, however, as a store of value, failing to meet one of the key definitions of money. The money games of the last 20 years set us up for the extreme bubble and crisis pattern we can't escape today. While there are a few tricks left to play on dollar holders, there aren't many. MMT will pull the U.S. from its most severe crisis. That's why if you pay attention, you'll see articles touting MMT today, well in advance of that final crisis. This is how media messaging works. Float the idea, let people say it's crazy. After a pause, float it again, and it sounds less crazy. Finally, during the next major crisis, deliver the formerly radical but now familiar idea as a bold solution to societal woes. When you see MMT in action, watch out. It means outright financing of government deficits with no intent to repay. It's direct monetization of government spending. What comes after the crisis that causes won't be pretty. Governments don't let go of power gracefully. Look across history. They hold the grip until there's nothing left. U.S. economic supremacy is all its current leaders have ever known. Their natural instinct won't be to let go. It will be to grip harder. They've already got the technology to do it. Created by intelligence, perfected by an unknowing private marketplace, it's set to turn the U.S. and the world into a financial prison. Chapter 17, Fedcoin. Total control. It's the ultimate desire of any government. When the U.S. runs into a crisis that's too big to fix, it will be a necessity. That day is not far off. In fact, technology already exists that could be used to make it happen. It would give government complete control of every dollar ever created. It would know when, where, how, and why every dollar changed hands. This is much more than digital money. It's instant access to every financial asset you own. This technology is impervious to computer hackers. Counterfeiting, tax evasion, and financial transgressions of any type are impossible. Sound like science fiction? It's already in use in the private markets today. Lenin said, "The capitalists will sell us the rope with which we will hang them." It's possible that far in advance of implementing this technology, the intelligence community planted its seeds in the private markets. It assumed, correctly, that private speculators would compete to perfect it. Once perfected, no more need for the speculators. Government's perfect tool for total money control would already be in place. Does this sound normal? See if you think something sounds a little bit off about this story. In August 2008, an anonymous web user registered the domain name bitcoin.org. 2 months later, a post appears. It's a white paper entitled Bitcoin, a peer-to-peer electronic cash system. The paper's author is Satoshi Nakamoto. No one knows who Satoshi is. His paper is brilliant. It explains that the traditional financial system relies on intermediaries to process payments. Whether it's a bank, title company, or credit card issuer, every payment sent from one person to another passes through a third party. Long ago, this made sense. Banks and other third parties created trust between two people who didn't know each other otherwise. For a small fee, the bank provided neutral ground. Satoshi said the advent of the internet age reduced the usefulness of these third parties. They were a burden. In the 2008 crisis, they caused financial distrust instead of solving it. Curiously, he posted the paper at the very beginning of the crisis. So he either wrote quickly or he had incredible instincts. In light of this old cumbersome system that failed us, Satoshi outlined a means of transacting between individuals without using a third party. Instead of leaning on those third parties for trust, his system used math. Better still, instead of relying on a central authority to issue his proposed digital currency, users of the currency created it by performing calculations on an open network. The coins were rewards. He called them bitcoins. Bitcoins are rewarded to users whose computers connect to the network to help solve cryptographic math problems that become progressively more difficult. That means it takes more and more computing power over time, making rewards more valuable. There would be a finite limit of bitcoins available as a reward, 21 million to be exact. While you're welcome to read the entire 9-page white paper online at bitcoin.org, the basic premise is simple. Initially, the value of Bitcoin was less than a dollar. I know because I had a meeting with a social acquaintance in 2009 who suggested we use old computers to mine these coins. This means we string these old computers together to run the code crunching protocol and take coins as rewards. This guy was a major cheapskate. He was, however, tech savvy. He had a business selling spare electronic parts. He obsessed over extracting every cent of value from anything resaleable. While worth at least $1 million at the time, this guy was so cheap he lived in a duplex operating the business out of the other side. I told him it sounded like a dumb idea. At the time, I wanted to buy single-family homes, gold, and gold stocks. I wasn't interested in much else. Turns out, my acquaintance had the better idea. My guess is we could have mined at least 1,000 Bitcoin with his plan. Remember, in the old days, it didn't take much computing power. 1,000 Bitcoin hit a peak value of 18.5 million just 8 years later. Bitcoin mania took hold. I heard about the idea endlessly from friends in the early days. Keep in mind, I wrote a rogue finance blog, I visited conferences with like-minded types, and I rarely turned down the chance to go see or do something that sounded interesting. All the while, I was a gold investor. I understood the history of gold and its usefulness in times of monetary turbulence. I also understood the gold market, which we'll get into in part 3. Look past the speculative frenzy. In August of 2017, in the middle of the Bitcoin speculation frenzy, I went to a party in Vancouver, British Columbia. I met a 28-year-old billionaire with his entire net worth held in Bitcoin. At dinner, I asked him if he was open to any financial advice. I advised